This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
How long can you live without food? How will we feed billions of people without fossil fuels? So many big questions that lead directly to your dinner and your health. Dee Dee Pareshaus has some answers for us. She's an American author, soil strategist, and teacher. Dee Dee founded the Land Leadership Initiative and literally gets to the roots that feed us all. From Vermont, Dee Dee Pareshaus, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We have so much on our minds, a pandemic, millions out of work, politics and stress. Why should perhaps city listeners take time to care about dirt?
Well, I like to actually call it soil. Dirt is what I call it when it's really degraded. And the difference between degraded dirt and healthy living soil is really the difference between something that is dead and alive. And that creates huge both structural and functional differences. So dirt, you could say, is just the sand, silt, and clay, the broken down rock particles that are sitting there in a dusty parking lot or a degraded farm as well, or ranch. If you think of that as being like flour, like the flour you might use for baking, if it's just those loose particles and you put that out in the rain or a big wind came along, they would move and blow away or roll away when that water or wind came along. And anyone who's done any baking knows that the water wouldn't soak in either. It would just run off the top. And so you're getting there in a landscape scale, you're getting flooding short term with the rain, so flash flooding. You're getting erosion, but you're also getting drought because the water's not sinking down in for the plant roots. Now, when you add life to that, if you have plants growing there, they photosynthesize and create sugars to both to build and grow themselves, and then also to feed all of life above the ground. But a large amount of their sugars goes down below the ground to feed other organisms. And those organisms move through the soil. We're talking about bacteria and fungi and a lot of other microscopic organisms, which then form the soil food web that all is eating each other and excreting nutrients for the plants as they move around, and they are getting nutrients from the minerals. But in that living process, there are all of these slimes and glues that all living things exude. And those slimes and glues and those little root hairs and fungal hyphae, which form threads, all tie those little sand, silt, and clay pieces together into a living matrix that has structural integrity. So it can't blow away, it can't roll off with water, but it also starts to have spaces in between. And those spaces, those little pore spaces, those little tunnels underground are where it all happens. You have air and water underground, and that's what you need for life. So it can soak up the water. Like it's, I say, if I started off talking about flour, if you think of a few slices of bread stacked on top of each other, that's what happens when you have living soil. It's like turning flour into bread. It's taking something that has no structural or functional integrity and turning it into this matrix that stays together and absorbs things and doesn't fall apart when it's wet or when the wind blows. And life happens in there, and then life keeps building it. So it's continually regenerating itself.
And if you don't have that living soil, I just want to pass on a little information that I found for our listeners. Two Canadian news outlets analyzed food grown 50 years ago to find out how it compares to what we buy in supermarkets now. And essential vitamins and minerals were hardly there. Their report says, the Globe and Mail newspaper, the average potato has lost 100% of its vitamin A, which is important for eyesight, 57% of vitamin C and iron, which you need for healthy blood, 28% of calcium, and so on. Dee Dee, does that match what you know about American food today?
Yes, that is true. And that also has to do with the work that's going on underground. I've got an article, recent article on Medium called Other Species Are Essential Workers, Whose Economies Enfold Our Own. And a big piece of that essential work is those microscopic organisms that extend the plant's root system out, break down the tiny rock particles and get the nutrients from them, pass them through the soil food web and back to the plant at exactly the right ratios at the timing that the plant needs them, because plants, just like people, need different nutrients at different times depending on what illnesses they're facing. Plants face viral illnesses, bacterial illnesses, fungal illnesses, genetic problems, stresses. So when a plant has all of those symbionts or symbiotic organisms working with it underground, it can get way more nutrients, but it also gets them in the proportions and the important ratios and in the time that it needs them the most. So plants will become much more resistant to disease. And then everything that eats the plants, including us, will also become more resistant to disease. And it's not just the big nutrients like calcium and vitamins, et cetera. There are lots and lots and lots of phytochemicals and micronutrients that we're learning about. Like you hear about superfoods that have certain things in them. We are just beginning to scratch the surface of understanding all of the different things that plants make that contribute to the health of everything else on Earth.
You took your soil teaching to India, to the state of Andhra Pradesh, where the zero-budget natural farming movement is blossoming. Please tell us, what is that zero-budget natural farming?
So zero-budget natural farming started with a teacher named Subhash Palikar, and Andhra Pradesh adopted that along with some other agroecological principles, some of which came out of the teachings of a colleague of mine and I, Walter Yena and I. That they were sort of inspired by our work on the soil sponge and on how water may be available to plants under drought conditions if we understand those symbiotic relationships. The basic foundation of zero-budget natural farming is the idea that everything that's needed for a farm or a garden can be sourced from within the village without relying on big companies for seeds, for fertilizer, for pesticides, et cetera. So it's kind of organic plus. All the seeds are things that are sourced locally. Instead of fertilizer, they use biostimulants made out of forest soils, cow dung and cow urine, herbs, et cetera, mixed together, fermented. The seeds are coated with those. The plants are sometimes sprayed with those. The soil is treated with those as needed. And then they make herbal pesticides when they're in transition, but over time they also plant different families of plants all in the same place. So there's a much more diversity and different sizes and shapes of plants within the same plot of land. So what that does is it tends to attract the insects to one part of the farm and away from the crop that's just ripening. It attracts insects that eat the ones that like to eat the crops. Because one of the things we've learned about pesticides, the work of Claire Lacan and John Lundgren found that the more pesticides, the more like insecticides that are used on a crop, the more pests are found in the field. And the reason for that is there's insects that eat plants and there are insects that eat insects. So if you kill off all the insects, who still has food left? The ones that eat the plant have food left. The ones that eat other insects don't have any food left. So the plant-eating ones will return first from other places. They'll come back from other places, or they will multiply in place from the populations that are left. So when we use different strategies that invite the diversity of insect life, you actually have way fewer pest problems over time. So these are some of the innovative ideas that they're using in Andhra Pradesh, including a lot of the soil health principles, so reducing tillage, always having cover crops growing, and now they have started, as I said, a lot of diversity, but they've also started planting things ahead of time before the seasonal rains, something that they're calling pre-monsoon dry sowing. That means that they can get a full crop in before the conventional farms. They're doubling farmers' incomes and even increasing the amount of food that's grown. And because they've reduced or eliminated pesticides, the health of the whole system, human health and ecological health, are both getting much, much better over time. it's now called community managed natural farming in the Andhra Pradesh community managed natural farming movement, because they've taken that ZBNF or ZBNF and adapted it specifically for these projects in Andhra Pradesh.
Well, this is also exciting for people around the world, really, because it also has big implications for climate change. All those fertilizers and the pesticides are made from fossil fuels or with a lot of fossil fuels, and then you have to transport them around the world, more fossil fuels, and the soil becomes a net emitter of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases instead of becoming something that can capture carbon dioxide out of the air. Talk to us about the relationship between soil health and climate change.
Yes, absolutely. So as you said, well, there's the machinery involved, which is one thing, but there's also the inputs. All of the fertilizers and pesticides rely on fossil fuels for both the raw materials and the manufacturing. But then there are other things that people don't tend to think about so much and that often haven't been counted in this accounting of agriculture's impact on climate. So when you till the soil, soil carbon is the living, the dead, and the very dead in the soil. So all of those living organisms in the soil, including things like earthworms, when they die off, the carbon that was in their bodies goes back into the air. So when you till the soil, you are breaking up those fungal hyphae that are so key for the plant's nutrients. You are exposing bacteria that don't want to be exposed to heat, to up to the sunlight and the heat and air, and you're killing off a lot of life in the soil, as well as nesting birds and mice and other little small mammals in the area. And then the soil carbon, the organisms that like to eat the dead carbon or the air, organic matter, those ones tend to come to life with tillage and start eating. And so then you're even destroying even more of the carbon in the soil. So just tillage alone is a big, big problem in terms of soil carbon. And we've lost a lot of soil carbon, and along with that, a lot of the fertility and the structural and functional integrity of what I like to call the soil sponge. That's that. If we go back to my first example, that's the bread example.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dee Dee Pearsos, and we're talking about soil and climate and your food and your health. Lots to cover here. I'd like to get in just a little bit of news again on the nexus of the climate movement and Indian farming. We have the young Indian climate activist Disha Ravi was arrested in the middle of February. Her supposed crime was providing a toolkit for farmers protesting new agricultural legislation. And other activists from Extinction Rebellion in India had their homes raided and computers taken. Do you have any ideas, Dee Dee, on why the government of India is now attacking climate activists?
Well, I don't understand that situation very well, but what I have heard, and this may or may not be accurate, is that legislation is really favoring the big international corporations that provide the input, and it is taking away the subsidies for the farmers to do their more traditional small farming. By taking away those subsidies, they are basically making it so that those farmers can't exist and bigger companies can swoop in and buy up the land. Land is at a premium right now for a variety of reasons, but, you know, climate change, we're losing fertile land dramatically every year. We're losing the water systems that go with that. And to complicate things, there are now these soil carbon markets emerging. And so there are companies that are setting the rules and prices for soil carbon, but then at the same time buying up land so that they can do their own practices there and get those carbon credits. So it's a pretty complex ecosystem. You know, we want soil carbon to be growing. We do want farmers to get paid for rebuilding, regrowing the soil sponge, which provides all kinds of climate mitigation as well, which we haven't gotten into yet. But when people start making their own rules and then buying up all of the, you know, all of the playing pieces in the game, it's just more of the same of that created this in the first place. I may not have everything straight there, but that's what it sounds like is going on to me.
It is very complex. You know, on the one hand, I can see that India's food distribution system needs some help. They lose, I've heard, up to 50% of their crops because they don't have refrigeration and distribution systems in. And it's complicated because they have hundreds of millions of small farmers who may have only an acre or 2 acres. We don't want to see a big enclosure movement like happened in the UK and have these people booted off their land. There's nowhere for them to go. It's a really, really hard situation. But when we come back to America, maybe we can see the future of Indian soil in the soy and cornfields of Iowa and other Midwestern states. What do you see in the U.S. agribusiness system when it comes to soil?
The U.S., a lot of our cropland isn't being used to grow food, first of all. It's being used to grow biofuels and things that make things that aren't useful for food, like high fructose corn syrup or cattle feed. You know, feed for animals that really should be, the animals should be part of growing a grassland. And a grassland can sequester tons of carbon, can hold water, can cool the region through transpiration, can provide flood resilience and drought resilience if it's managed well, if it's managed with holistic decision making or something that really understands how land works. So if we were to manage U.S. farmland with these more rational frameworks for decision making, where we understand what are all the externalities here by doing this choice versus that one, not can I extract more value, not just how much yield can I have here, but what is the impact on the whole system? If we could understand that and make our choices with a bigger frame to look through, then I think we have a chance at changing how weather works, what the temperature of regions are, perhaps changing the global climate, but certainly providing much more climate resilience. But currently, farmers in the U.S. are basically being paid to fail. They get payments when they have losses from flooding and drought. And I'm not saying we should cut those out right away. We need to figure out something that takes their place. But crop insurance subsidies is a huge piece of farmer income. Farmers have to go into terrible debt every year to buy all of these inputs, and then their margins of what they get in return are very tiny. So U.S. farmers are being squeezed in terrible ways by the current system, and there are people who are figuring it out. But I do think that what we're seeing in Andhra Pradesh, India, of having a whole state that is going towards natural farming is a real model for the U.S. and the rest of the world, that I think they have figured out something about people leading this movement that we're not quite there yet in the States. In the States, it's a lot more like what's called in the soil health movement, the herd quitters. So people who tend to go against the usual status quo, who are experimenting with this, rather than it being like, let's all do this together. So we need to figure out something about working together in the States, you know, across boundaries. And one of the beautiful things about the soil health movement is that it is bringing together people who vote for different people. You know, it is bringing together people who identify as more conservative or liberal towards a much greater aim. And I think that's very hopeful.
I agree. Well, you know, another sort of hopeful sign is that some of the billionaires of America, Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, are waking up to the fact that climate change is going to wipe out the base of their business and a lot of the population, possibly, if we don't get this under control. But they're looking for carbon capture and storage technology. They picture great big machines that are chewing up the air and sucking out the carbon. Whereas there is a fairly going group in New England and in other places of America and around the world who want to get this carbon capture into the soil with the kind of techniques that you teach. What have you seen in your region?
I would say that the big thing there is understanding that nature invented carbon capture technology long ago. It's called a plant, and it's also called people. So like each of us is sequestering carbon for 50 to 100 years in our bodies. Like if you start to understand that carbon is not a bad thing. Carbon is the building block of life. And it's just that we need the right amount of carbon in living systems, and we need some carbon in the air. If we don't have carbon, CO2 in the air, plants can't continue to feed living systems. So it's about getting the carbon in the right place, in the right forms, at the right times, and have it flowing through the system rather than seeing it as something bad, or even that it's bad in the air and it's good in the soil. It's not a bad or good thing. It's about understanding how living systems work. So an example in New England that we're seeing is that there's a movement I find quite disturbing of cutting down forests and burning them as a clean technology, and then maybe getting even carbon credits for that without understanding that trees are carbon that has been captured, and that trees provide a lot of other things besides carbon storage or fuel, that every plant that is photosynthesizing is also transpiring water. And transpiring water is like sweating. It's what you do to cool off when you're too hot, and plants do that as part of the photosynthesis process. So that takes water that's in a liquid form that they've taken up from their roots in the soil, and it turns it into a vapor, into a gas. And in that process, it actually removes a huge amount of heat from the surface of the leaves or the pine needles, but also from the air around it. And so forests and trees in cities, et cetera, are like enormous air conditioners. So if we cut down the trees because it's a cleaner fuel, if we cut them down en masse, I'm not talking about carefully managed forests, but we are actually going to heat up the climate in New England very, very drastically. And we're going to completely disrupt the water cycle, because those forests also provide bacteria through that transpiration stream that goes up into the air and helps rain clouds to form and raindrops to fall. There's only three ways to make something big enough to fall down out of the sky as a raindrop. There's salts, which happen over the oceans. There's ice, which happens usually at higher altitudes. And there are these hygroscopic bacteria that can bring enough water to them as they're floating in the air to make something large enough to fall as a raindrop. And those come from forests. And if we don't, if we cut down our forests to solve one little piece of the problem and don't understand all the other things that they're doing, we're going to have a hot, dry desert on the East Coast in the Northeast. It's happened all over the world. This is how deserts are formed. You can see places where the rainfall has stopped and it moves around where there used to be a forest to go find the place where there are the trees. So it's a big issue in the Northeast.
Dee Dee, you give so many workshops around America and in other countries, and many of them are available as free videos on your website. But how have you adapted during the pandemic?
Well, luckily, I had actually already shifted to doing a lot more online teaching through the Land and Leadership Initiative, which you can find at landandleadership.org. The and is spelled out. What's fun about teaching online is that we get people from all over the world working together. So my classes are very participatory. It's not just me spewing out information and people trying to digest it. People learn by working in small groups, thinking through their own experiences with forests, with land, with farming, with food, with their own economics, and then building together this picture of how living systems work. And what happens in the process is these amazing communities form of the people who've taken that course together. This last one that I taught last week, we had folks from Mongolia and Sweden and England and all over the U.S. and in India, and it's just really fun to hear how things work in other places, what people are trying in other places. So there's a lot of learning that happens from participant to participant rather than me trying to be an expert. I always say there's no experts here. Like, we're all the expert of our own context, and you can learn from every single person in this course.
In your books, like The Ecology of Care, soil health and human health come together. In fact, those two are part of your personal life experience. What is the medical connection to a soil strategist?
Well, a lot of people think that it's an issue of that the soil bacteria literally are the same as the bacteria in our guts that we've learned are so important. That's not entirely true because most soil bacteria are more aerobic and most of our gut bacteria are anaerobic. So it's not quite as direct as that, but it goes more to, in terms of the nutritional piece, more to what we were talking about earlier, that the soil bacteria and soil fungi and all of the soil life makes sure that the plant is getting optimal nutrition at every minute in that moment around the plant. And of course, if we eat locally and we eat plants that are grown in a healthy system, then we are getting the nutrition that we need to deal with the illnesses that are in that same ecosystem at that same time. So that's one piece. But then the other thing is that all of these effects of climate change, the flooding, the drought, the wildfires, the water shortages, the food shortages, the conflicts over resources and the trauma and stresses that go along with that, with forced migration, those can all be addressed by having a soil sponge, by having a functional living matrix of soil. Every single one of those, including the issues of too much CO2 in the atmosphere. So each one of those things carries with it, takes a toll on human health. Every single one of those things I just listed has health impacts along with it. So by addressing, by regenerating the soil sponge, we can address all of the health impacts as well as all of the things that we need going forward to regenerate life on this planet. Diverse, beautiful life that does all the work that happens on the planet.
Of course, we're running out of time too soon. What have you got coming up, and how can listeners tune into your work?
Okay, well, I have a couple of different websites that people might be interested in. One is landandleadership.org, and that's where you will find some resources that we've been putting together that you can read more about, articles that I've written there, or you can find those also on medium.com under D.D. Pursehouse. I've got classes that start every couple of weeks. We are now also starting a 6-month intensive program that some people are joining who've just taken classes with me. And then I have a personal website, ddpursehouse.com, where you can find more videos of talks that I've given and links to my 2 books. And then there's another website called rehydratecalifornia.org that is not as active of a website, but has some very interesting resources, and that's kind of a spot that I've helped create for multi-stakeholder initiatives looking at rehydrating arid and semi-arid areas like California through growing the sponge, through collaborating with other species, and through collaborating with each other. So I invite people to find any of those. You can also, the Ecology of Care is available online through my website and also Kindle and Amazon as well.
If you missed any of that, I'm going to put all kinds of links in my show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Dee Dee, it's been really great to finally connect with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, wonderful. And hope everybody out there will stop disturbing the soil, create diverse plants that are growing all around. More diversity is better, and any soil that's there, make sure that something's growing there. Doesn't matter what it is, just let it grow.
I'm doing that in my back food garden. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you, everyone, for listening this week and caring for your world.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.